Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I are going to be talking to Dr. Charles Benbrook about his research on GMOs. Initially, genetically engineered herbicide-resistant and insect-resistant crops were created for the purpose of conserving fuel, reducing tillage, and to decrease overall use of insecticides. This strategy was the premise for the successful sale of this technology within the global agricultural sector. Almost two decades later, there's a big question as to whether or not this technology has been able to deliver the promises it has made. What exactly has happened over the last 16 years? As the increased use of applications of neonicotinoids continues, commercial beekeepers are facing record bee losses. There is also great concern regarding the impact on human health as the demand to create transparency in food labeling continues. What appears to be an uphill battle, especially after the failure to pass Prop 37 in the state of California, which would have mandated GMO labeling. So on today's show, we're going to talk to Dr. Charles Benbrook about his research, and we'll get into some of these issues. But first, I would like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon,
Hello,
Tom.
Hello, June.
And our guest today, Dr. Chuck Benbrook. Good afternoon, Dr. Benbrook.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me back on.
Dr. Benbrook, can you please tell our audience about yourself and also some of the research that you've been conducting?
Sure. I'm a research professor at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University out here in the beautiful state of Washington. I live in Northeast Oregon, just south of Pullman, where the main agricultural campus is of Washington State University. I've been involved in the science leading to genetically engineered foods since the early 1980s, actually, and have conducted research basically throughout my career on the regulation and risk assessment and use by farmers of today's genetically engineered crops. My work has focused on their impact on pest management systems and pest pressure and pesticide use, as well as on a variety of impacts on the environment.
Thank you. With this particular research that we're going to be focusing on today, can you please explain to our audience the specific crops that, as well as the technology that was used to protect the crops?
Sure. Around the world, the most widely planted genetically engineered crops are corn, soybeans, and cotton. In addition to these three major crops that account for probably 95% of the total acreage of genetically engineered crops, there's also genetically engineered canola or rapeseed, genetically engineered alfalfa and sugar beets, as well as a few vegetable crops that and fruit crops, for example. There's a virus-resistant squash variety, virus-resistant papaya, and in an important development, just this last year, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new genetically engineered sweet corn developed by Monsanto that expresses three different BT proteins as well as is herbicide tolerant to Roundup or glyphosate. So this new sweet corn is the first human food stuff that people eat a significant amount in a largely unprocessed form. After all, when we have sweet corn, we just boil it for for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, and,
mm-hmm.
and so we're ingesting those BT proteins in a form close to how they exist in the raw product. So those are the major crops, and then the two major traits that are out there involve making plants resistant to broad spectrum herbicides so that these herbicides can be applied throughout the growing season over the top of the crop, leaving the crop unharmed but controlling the weeds. The second major category of genetically engineered crops are the so-called insect protected or BT transgenic crops, and the two examples of those are BT corn and BT cotton. And these GE plants actually manufacture a bioinsecticide in all of the growing cells of the plant, so that when an insect chews on the plant starts to damage the plant, the insect ingests hopefully a toxic dose of these protein-based insecticides and kills the insect.
Thank you. What were they doing prior to this technology as far as combating these different pests?
Okay, in the case of weed control and the use of herbicides, prior to 1996, the year when these technologies were introduced to the market, U.S. farmers were actually having a lot of trouble in dealing with weeds. The products on the market at the time worked well in some cases, but not all. There was already significant problems with resistant weeds that were not controlled by some of the market leader products. Some of the products had to be applied very, very carefully because they're extremely active biologically. Some of them were applied at less than 1/100th of a pound per acre, extremely low doses, so that just a 3-ounce bottle mm-hmm. would treat 5 acres. And also some of them interacted with either fertilizers or other pesticides that the farmer might be applying and created crop damage and other problems. So farmers were struggling with weed management. It was working less well and costing them more. And so when the so-called Roundup Ready system came out, the genetically engineered corn, soybeans, and cotton, making it possible for farmers to accomplish effective season-long weed control with a single application of one herbicide, it was a huge step forward from the perspective of the farmers. They were willing to pay the much higher price for seeds. They were willing to pay for the glyphosate herbicide that was necessary to be used in conjunction with them. And they actually did enjoy 4 or 5 or 6 years of essentially trouble-free weed control. But it was really the remarkable success of the technology and the rapid adoption of it, and then the sole reliance on it that set the stage for the problems that we're experiencing today. In the case of controlling insects, in the case of corn, the primary insect management strategy that corn farmers used was simply to rotate corn with soybeans. Simply by doing that, most corn farmers did not have to apply any insecticide. Beginning in the early 1990s, a new variant of an important corn insect pest emerged that developed the ability to overwinter in a soybean field. So in effect, it undermined the effectiveness. It didn't eliminate, but it reduced the effectiveness of the traditional corn-soybean rotation. This led to more recognition that corn farmers had a problem. It really opened the door in 1996 when BT corn came along to encourage more farmers to purchase that technology. The availability of BT corn has made it possible for many corn farmers now to grow continuous corn year in and year out, and this has brought about a number of adverse impacts on the overall health of corn production systems, and actually is the reason that the corn plant itself is just much more vulnerable to a range of insect and plant disease pests than it was 15 years ago.
Dr. Benbrook, we have a question from the audience. It was emailed to us, and the question concerns the actual rotation of crops. And the question is it possible that the industry actually sabotaged that process by encouraging the existence of this corn borer in the crops or in the soil?
No. That's, I mean, even I can't imagine it being possible, and if it was, they wouldn't do that. But, you know, the business model of the seed industry completely changed from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s. In that 10-year period, in effect, the global pesticide industry purchased the seed industry, took it over. Because it was the pesticide industry and the global corporations active in that business that were investing in and developing these new transgenic biotechnology methods to control pests. But, of course, the delivery mechanism for that technology is the seed. And so the pesticide industry, which was about four times larger than the seed industry and also about three times more profitable in terms of your basic measure of net profit per unit of sale. The pesticide industry bought the seed industry and then was able to decide which traits, which GE traits to put in which plants. And as a result of that, they really drove the adoption of the technology and have now dramatically narrowed the choices that farmers have. Because, you know, today when corn and soybean and cotton farmers go to their seed store, there's very limited supplies of non-GE seeds. In fact, there's only enough non-GE soybean and corn seed to plant at most 10% of national acres. So regardless of whether farmers want to plant GE varieties or not, 90% of the corn and soybean crops next year are going to be genetically engineered. And because farmers are paying a very substantial premium for those GE traits, they have to take advantage of them, even though today they're not working that well and they're creating other problems. So, things have changed so dramatically in the last 15 years in these major sectors of agriculture that we just simply are not keeping up with the changes, and unfortunately, you know, farmers face their own kind of weed management cliff now because of the spread of glyphosate-resistant weeds.
Dr. Benbrook, you've said in your research that there's been a 30% shift in corn, soybean, and cotton income from farmers to the chemical industry and the seed producers. Could you just comment on that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, if you take historical USDA data on crop yields and the price that farmers sell their corn, soybeans, and cotton for, it's very easy to calculate their gross income per acre. It's also very easy to calculate, based on published USDA data, what farmers spend on seed and pesticides and fertilizers and all their other various costs of production. And from you know, the standard USDA measures of gross income and costs. The USDA has calculated the net return per acre for a farmer growing an acre of soybeans or an acre of corn or an acre of cotton. And if you look at those data series, and in particular in the last, you know, 5 to 8 years when the price of these GE seeds have really gone up so dramatically, we see that there's been a transfer of, I estimate, you know, over a 10-year average, about 30% of the money that would wind up in the farmer's pocket is now being paid instead to the seed, pesticide, biotech industry for to cover the premium that's prices that are associated with the these GE seeds. And you know, I think that you know, this is historically this is a historically significant transfer of wealth that has dramatically strengthened both economically and politically the seed, pesticide, biotech industry, and actually weakened farmers. In the early part of the adoption of this technology from, say, 1996 to 2006, the first decade, farmers were willing to pay the extra money and were willing to take the hit on their net income per acre because farming was so much easier, and what many farmers did to compensate was they simply got bigger. They outbid neighbors and expanded their operations, maintaining their overall income but making fewer dollars per acre. But again, beginning around 2006, when problems started to arise from the spread of resistant weeds and other plant health problems with that appear to be caused in one way or another by these transgenic cropping systems, it really started to cut into farmers both their income and also get more complicated again. So the very original purpose of the technology, which was to simplify pest management and free farmers up to deal with other factors, has kind of eroded. And ironically now, university entomologists are recommending to corn farmers to go back and spray the old corn insecticides to prevent resistance to the new BT traits in the corn, which just, you know, is a you know, tragic irony from the perspective of the farmer, because now they're putting up with the environmental risks associated with the old insecticides, the cost of spraying the old insecticides, and they're paying these huge premiums for the new GE seed.
So have the seed prices escalated so dramatically because of cost of production or because the seed companies have a captive audience?
Good question and really easy answer. The seed prices have gone up so much because of the ability of the seed biotech industry to patent seeds and charge a premium for the genetically engineered traits that are embedded in the seed. The reason that Monsanto and the other technology developers have thrived so much and the value of their stock gone up so much is because they're making very significant profits from every bag of seed that they sell. It doesn't cost them nearly as much to produce the transgenic trait and get it into the seed as what they're charging for it. So their profit margin has gone up very substantially. So the reason that farmers are caught in a bind now is that they have nowhere to go. I mean, there really is not, as I said, there's only about 10% of the corn and soybean seed that's non-GE. And so, you know, the farmers are stuck with having to purchase the GE traits that the industry is willing to offer them at the price they're charging.
The charge has been leveled by many that the farm community has been turned into drug addicts, and now that they have been captured, that it's simply going to escalate. Even for those of us outside of the science, it's no surprise that we would develop these resistant insects and resistant weeds. These technologies seem to be designed to fail.
Well, I don't buy the characterization that farmers are drug addicts, and you know, frankly, I think we need to drop that kind of language. I think that they were sold this technology based on a lot of very rosy estimates of all the good that was going to come from it. I think the government was grossly negligent in not adequately testing the technology up front, and also not imposing some limits on its use to prevent the kind of problems with resistance that we now see. In fact, the EPA did do, a responsible job in trying to prevent and manage resistance to the BT proteins in BT corn and cotton. And for the most part, that has been effective, although there's clear signs now that resistance is starting to emerge in the key target insects to today's major BT genes. And this is extremely important that the EPA rapidly intervene and change their policies and restrictions that are placed on the technology, or in 2 or 3 or 4 years the value of these BT crops will be lost, just as for the most part the value of the Roundup Ready gene and Roundup Ready technology has been essentially eliminated in the southeastern U.S. and is on the path to obsolescence elsewhere in the country, where farmers are largely reliant on Roundup Ready technology. So, you know, I think farmers, perhaps they were a bit more gullible than they should have been, and they were too quick to ignore lessons from the recent past. Whenever the farmers have relied too much on any individual pest management technology, it's predictable that problems are going to emerge. So, you know, I'm not going to say farmers are not totally at fault, but I think that they were really driven down this path by an industry that had found a new business model that was highly profitable. And really, it was at a time when universities were facing huge budget cuts at both the state and the federal level. So the independent voice of the university pest management scientist was muffled at best, and the government thought that this technology was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and didn't really do its job either. So that's has brought us to the.
What do you think the future holds for American farmers, and do you think there's a way out of this?
Sure. There's a way out of it, but it's going to take time, and it's going to cost money, and unfortunately, the response by the seed biotech pesticide industry is they're trying to get the government to approve sort of second generation herbicide tolerant crops that are genetically engineered to resist multiple herbicides, and on the crazy notion that farmers already dealing with herbicide resistant weeds because they've sprayed too much herbicide in the past can spray their way out of this corner. There's absolutely no evidence that is going to work, and in fact, almost all weed scientists are speaking up now, even some that are getting industry money, and saying this is a flawed approach. But as I said, the farmers have to buy the seeds that the seed industry produces and puts on sale. There's no other source of seed. So, unfortunately, this highly profitable...
That's how they made the industry, though. I mean, if you look back, I just want to touch upon this really briefly, but if you look back in time, we were dealing with famines I remember just as a kid seeing the commercials with the children in Ethiopia with the swollen stomachs and, you know, the need to produce more food to feed people. I mean, that was a very big concern. Even the Vatican supported it. And then once they realized what the impact could be, they started having a change of tune. But unfortunately, you know, they unleashed something that couldn't exactly be put back into the box.
Well, the leap to global food security is a big one. But I mean, you know, if we were really concerned about global food security, we probably wouldn't be using 45% of our corn crop to make ethanol. You know, it's pretty obvious that that other economic interests and goals have driven, you know, production agriculture in the United States. And and as many of your sophisticated listeners know, the problem with hunger and malnutrition around the world is grounded in poverty and lack of access to land and social and cultural conflict and instability, much more than it is from a overall global shortage of food. The world already produces far more food than would be needed to provide everyone on Earth with, you know, 2,200 calories a day. But it's the distribution of food and the fact that we've got a billion people that are chronically hungry in the world, and a billion people that are chronically overfed, and increasingly suffering from obesity and diabetes and other problems. I mean, the people that are trying to promote genetically engineered crops as the solution to global food security issues are really doing a disservice, because it's just not what the core issue is all about.
Thank you, Dr. Benberg. And we're almost out of time, but just if you could take a moment to just talk about the impact on human health as far as the technology.
Well, you know, one of the great frustrations among many of us that have worked on this for so long is that it's been the policy of the U.S. government that genetically engineered crops are substantially equivalent to their non-engineered counterparts, and as a result, the U.S. government has invested no money in independent research on these technologies. And while, despite claims from the biotech industry that these are the most carefully studied foods and technology ever introduced, it's simply not true. I mean, if you look at artificial sweeteners, for example, there's been more research on a single artificial sweetener, saccharin, than all genetically engineered crops put together, particularly research on long-term health effects on people, on mammals. So the technology has really gotten a free pass, and so the basic question is: do these crops pose new and unique risks? I mean, nobody really knows, and there would be no reason or way for people to know, based on the fact that the vast majority of the GE crops that have been grown in the U.S. have not been consumed directly by people. They've been either fed to animals, are processed into oil, or in the case of corn, into high fructose corn syrup or to ethanol. That's why this new genetically engineered sweet corn that will come on the market in the summer of 2013 for the first time in substantial volume is such an important development, because if there is a problem with GE crops and, say, food allergies, one would expect be triggered by this new GE sweet corn. But if it's not labeled, how's anybody going to know whether they had the genetically engineered sweet corn or the regular sweet corn?
Do you think that at some point there will be even more independent research that will come out from other parts of the world that will demonstrate the impact of these types of technologies, not only on the environment, but also on human health? I mean, do you think that the industry will block that?
Well, I think the industry is quite content with the general conventional wisdom that alleges that these technologies are perfectly safe. But there is independent research being done in Europe, and what's going to happen, June? And here's my crystal ball. I think that U.S. agricultural commodity groups are going to realize that they're losing access to markets because of concern about the health and environmental impacts of GE technology and because of a lack of confidence in the U.S. regulatory infrastructure that really is responsible for bringing this technology onto the global stage. Once Cargill and ADM and corn farmers and soybean farmers begin to realize that they're losing access to markets and hence income because people have doubts, I think at that point the support will grow in the U.S. for the U.S. government through the National Institute for Health, through the National Science Foundation, to do the careful, independent, long-term human health studies that should have been done 15 years ago when this technology was first brought forward. But I think it's coming, but the only thing that's going to overcome the resistance in the industry is demand, demand from